Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The field of genetics is rife with possibilities. In healthcare, what we're learning about the human genome is giving rise to new ideas for treating painful and debilitating diseases. Criminal investigators have used DNA to solve cases that seemingly went cold decades ago. And according to our guest today, DNA can help us on a cultural level as well by shedding new light on our backgrounds. Brian Sykes is an Oxford professor of human genetics, and he's pioneered the use of DNA in exploring the human past. The sometimes surprising findings uncovered by that research are raising new questions about human history and how we define and understand ourselves. Sykes has traveled the world learning about the genetic makeup of humans and recently traveled the United States, collecting DNA from people of many backgrounds and finding many hidden cultural connections contained in their genetic histories. White Southerners with biological connections to Africa and African Americans with evidence of European DNA. Now he's put his findings together in a book he calls A Genetic Biography of America, the country often called the world's cultural melting pot. Today on The Exchange, DNA USA, thinking about race, ancestry, and biology through the lens of genetics. And let's hear from you, too. Have you had a chance to get your DNA sampled? Were you surprised with what you found? Do you work in the field of genetics or use DNA in your job? Are you excited about the use of DNA to explore your past? Are you concerned about it? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post your comments on our Facebook page. Our guest is Brian Sykes, a professor of human genetics at the University of Oxford. He's a founder of Oxford Ancestors and the author of several books on genetics, including his latest DNA USA, which is published in America on May 1st. Brian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
This kind of work is relatively new, just a few decades old, really. And we should say that the kind of DNA you're looking at is actually different from what, say, an investigator would collect at a crime scene. Am I understanding that right?
Yes, it is different. When we're looking at the past, we use different sorts of DNA than you might do, for example, to get a personal identification from something at a crime scene. Sure. The DNA that I've used for about 20 years now is one that comes down the maternal line called mitochondrial DNA.
Based off of the mitochondria in the cells.
That's from the mitochondria in the cells, that's right. The unusual thing about mitochondrial DNA is that you only get it from your mother. So if you can, and everybody's got it, but only women pass it on. So you and I will have mitochondrial DNA ready.
We're going to have to get through this somehow.
We've got it from our mothers, who got it from their mothers and their mothers and their mothers. So that traces one single line of ancestry way, way back into the past. You can get back thousands of years along that line and eventually connect everyone on the planet up to a sort of a super family tree going along the mitochondrial line.
And why is it that, is this a kind of DNA that's preserved more easily in remains that are, say, tens of thousands of years old?
Yes, that's right, it is. And actually, that's why I started to look at that. Although DNA USA looks at lots of other ways of examining DNA, not just mitochondria. But I started to target mitochondria when I was really getting into this field by looking at ways of getting DNA from ancient human fossils. This was the late 80s, and there's just more of it in a cell. There are sometimes thousands of copies of mitochondrial DNA where there might only be one or two of the more regular chromosome DNA.
Are there particular conditions that make it easier to preserve that mitochondrial DNA for thousands of years?
Yep. It's not just the age of the, not really the age of the specimen, the fossil that determines whether we're going to get any DNA out of it. It's really its condition of preservation. So you can have bones and teeth, for example, might only be 100 years old. You can't find anything if it's been lying out in the open. But if a bone or a skeleton is found in a limestone cave particularly, then the DNA lasts for thousands of years. And that's because it's very closely linked to and stuck to, really, the matrix of the bone, the calcium. And that, if it's a limestone cave, which is basically calcium anyway, the calcium stays and the DNA stays behind.
in a case like that, then you would find what looks like a promising sample, and you would take that back to the lab, and how then do you analyze what you have?
Well, in that case, you have to get rid of everything else and just leave the DNA behind. So the first thing we would do is to dissolve out the calcium in a bone or a tooth, and then we use powerful chemicals and enzymes to digest away the protein, and we get rid of the fat, what remains, and then eventually all that we're left with is the DNA, which is itself a very tough molecule. However, in old DNA, it's damaged. It's broken up into small chunks, which can be difficult to put together again, and also can lead to damaged results. But perhaps the worst thing is, the most difficult and troublesome aspect of it is, that if you touch the sample or anyone else has touched it, then you're going to recover that DNA because it's much more modern, it's in much better condition. So contamination has always been a real problem with ancient DNA work, and you're continues to be so.
Looking at 10,000-year-old DNA and, oh wait, that's my DNA, actually.
I think every single specimen that I ever looked at, however careful I was, I dressed up in sort of a total coverage suit, and I always found a tiny bit of my own DNA.
Well, you had mentioned a moment ago tracing back to common ancestors, and when you talk about that, we should say, for example, you've written about the 7 common ancestors for Native Europeans, but that doesn't necessarily mean you found the remains of 7 specific women and matched their DNA to people that are more recent.
No, not at all. I mean, although we have found very old examples of the same DNA in fossils. No, what these 7 women are, I found, looking at modern Europeans, that people fell easily into 7 different genetic groups, which I call clans, through their mitochondrial DNA. And so it's a sort of inevitable logic. It's astounding when you first think of it, but it must be true that all of those groups that have comparable or sometimes exactly the same mitochondrial DNA have originally come from descended from one single woman along that maternal line. So these 7 women, although they lived up to 40,000 years ago, we know what their DNA was like by reconstructing it. We haven't found the women, in other words.
Today on The Exchange, a genetic biography of the United States. Oxford professor and renowned geneticist Brian Sykes is joining us to discuss his new book, DNA USA, in which he takes us on a historical genetic tour of this country and reveals some intriguing connections. We'd love to get your questions and comments in, too, at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Now, typically, what we know about ancient human activity is through physical records. We find a stone tool, we find some physical remains of a person or evidence of settlements. Are there cases where genetic research seems to suggest one conclusion, one course of activity, and the physical record seems to point in an opposite or at least different direction?
Well, it can happen. I mean, what we can't tell from DNA is what the person who had it was actually up to. So these records, for example, finding bones at hunter-gatherer camps or even with weapons, arrow tips and so on, in the human remains, which has happened. I mean, they tell you what the people were doing at the time. And then the DNA can be linked to particular movements of people in a large sense. So, for example, in Europe, the first people there, like everywhere else, were hunter-gatherers. And then people came in from the Middle East, where farming was first invented about 10,000 years ago. And you can see that in the archaeological record, that you begin to pick up new genetic features, new genetic fingerprints from those people coming in to Europe about 10,000 years ago, and with bringing with them the skills and equipment needed for agriculture, for early agriculture. And you can trace those movements and through the middle of Europe and around the Mediterranean, routes that archaeological remains have suggested is the way that farmers came into Europe. Yeah, so you can link the two together and tell what nowadays, what somebody was tell anybody that whether their ancient ancestor was a hunter-gatherer at that time or a farmer.
And sometimes those movements are... sometimes it takes us a while to wrap our heads around them. I'm thinking of the example, and forgive my pronunciation, the Nootcha Nolt in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
And they have a genetic connection to people in a very different part of the Pacific.
They do. That was the very first time that Native American DNA was tested. But I think before we go any further on talking about Native American DNA, I should say it was done in a, not deliberately, but eventually an underhand way, in that Native Americans' DNA was collected for other reasons, for medical research reasons usually, and then scientists used it without consent of the original donors for working with ancient ancestry research. Now, I don't think it was, that shouldn't have been done anyway, but what I think the researchers who were lastly of European origin hadn't appreciated was that the American Indian tribes have their own spiritual beliefs about their origins, which basically are that they didn't come from anywhere else. They have been in America for as long as the world has existed, so they've always been here. So when the genetic results showed, for example, that many of them had genetic ancestry in Siberia and Asia, this caused great offense and still continues to make Native American groups on the whole very suspicious of DNA research. So having said that, this is something that I talk about in the book, and I did go to Native American reservations and talk to Native Americans about how they felt. But from the genetic point of view, the original Nootcha Nolt in Indians from Vancouver Island showed the basic structure of most American Indian tribes, in that they contained four different clan mothers, four different clans of DNA. So whereas Europeans had seven, the Native Americans have four. In fact, there's a fifth, which is very interesting. We can talk about that in a bit, perhaps.
That's right. We'll pick that right back up after we take a short break. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Good morning, it's 9:19. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Fenton Family Dealerships in Keene, Toyota, Volvo, Honda, Subaru, and Hyundai. Treating the needs of each individual customer with singular concern. FentonDealerships.com. And from the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, turning investments into loans and education to create opportunity and transform lives. CommunityLoanFund.org. More on the complicated genetic melting pot of America on The Exchange on NHPR, and attend on the Diane Rehm Show, a former Secretary of State and a veteran CIA advisor, on America's role in the world. New Hampshire weather today, clouding up, chance of some showers, especially in western areas of the state. Highs today, 57 to 62 for most of the state, from 52 to 56 in the North Country. Tonight, cloudy, showers or rain coming to an end. Lows from upper 30s to lower 40s in most of the state, near 35 from the White Mountains north. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, author and renowned geneticist Brian Sykes is joining us to talk about his new book, DNA USA. And we invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you'll go to our page and join the conversation there. Brian, just before the break, we were talking about Native American DNA and some studies and research that had shown that there were some connections in other parts of the world. And you mentioned how that DNA was actually used, it was originally collected for medical research, not for genetic research. And that brings up something that I've been thinking about in terms of this research, which is that genetic makeup is a loaded subject. The Native American issues that you mentioned are one example, but you also wrote about how the eugenics movement at the turn of the last century was using, say, the high incidence of certain diseases in Ashkenazi Jews to conclude that Jews were separate and therefore inferior. So this is not simply a piece of research that doesn't relate to the rest of the world.
No, certainly not. And the eugenics movement for geneticists these days is a warning about where things can go very wrong. As we know now that all of the stuff that the eugenics movement tried to use to prove that there was some kind of biological connection between race and genetics was totally wrong and very bad science. But nonetheless, it is a warning, and I always shudder to think, as in fact some of my Jewish friends do, what would have happened if the Third Reich had got hold of DNA testing. Fortunately, it wasn't around at the time, so they couldn't have done it. But in the discussions with my Jewish friends, we always come to the conclusion that they would have used it in an extremely bad way, tried to find, for example, Ashkenazi Jews by DNA, and got done even more terrible things as a result of that. But DNA USA and my other books have always shown that that there's no one-to-one correspondence between genetics and race. That's not to say that, for example, African Americans don't have more African DNA than European Americans in them, and by and large they do. But you can never define anybody by their DNA.
In a way, the DNA research sheds light on the way we construct our sense of culture. And you have a story in the book about there's a professor from Dartmouth, actually, who was in the UK looking for a history of blacks in the UK, and she got an interesting response from the shopkeeper.
Yes, that's right. She was looking for some evidence. She's a well-known biographer, and she was saying, "Well, I'm looking for books on the presence of Africans in Britain in the 18th and 19th century." And the shopkeeper said, the bookshop assistant said, "Madam, there were no Africans in Britain before 1945.
And yet there had been Africans since Roman times in that part of the world.
Absolutely. And I've got a bit of African DNA in my own body. So and that, I think, probably came from a Roman, maybe a Roman slave or a Roman visitor from Africa all those years ago, and has percolated down through time to me.
You've described this project, this book, DNA USA, as sort of the last big project. The metaphor is like a bank robber who goes after the one last score before retiring. And I can see why you would think of it that way. America is a large country in terms of population and in terms of size, with all kinds of diversity, and it leads to so many avenues of inquiry. Where do you even start when you take on something that big?
Well, it was gigantic, and I decided actually to do it differently than to the way I'd approached other projects in other parts of the world. So this one, I thought, I'd actually just seen the movie Easy Rider a few days before I began to plan this project. And I thought, well, look, instead of hugely detailed planning and hundreds of volunteers, I think we'll just go and see what happens, really, rather like Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper, Jack Nicholson wandered around the southwestern United States aimlessly, and lots of things happened to them. So it was an Easy Rider themed project, and in fact, rather than have a lot of research assistance on this, I only had myself and my son Richard and my wife Ulla, and we did it between us and travelled around, partly on the train, meeting Americans, and when they agreed, which they I think always did, take a DNA sample and see what happened.
And it seems like there's so much interest and a growing interest. I mean, obviously, there's always been an interest in genealogy in the United States, but we're starting to see in popular culture, we're starting to see television shows. There's The Faces of America on PBS, and NBC has Who Do You Think You Are? Does that reflect well on this kind of work, or do you worry that it creates inaccurate perceptions about genetics?
Well, I don't think it does. I mean, I've been involved in some of these shows. They have a similar one in Britain, and occasionally we do a little bit of DNA work for them. It's just another way of telling a story through the history and biography of celebrities, and it goes down well. Nothing really wrong with that. I was rather keen myself to just include ordinary Americans in my book, so So I didn't even try to get hold of any celebrity DNA. I think that that's best left to others, particularly in another country. So I was always aware that it was slightly impertinent, maybe, of a British professor to be looking into the DNA of America. But then I thought, well, heavens, you know, American and European scientists have been looking into the DNA of other parts of the world without worrying about it. So I thought, why not?
Sort of makes you a genetic version of Alexis de Tocqueville, almost, traveling the country and checking it out from that perspective.
Europeans have been wandering around America commenting on what they find for quite a long time. There's a rich history of it.
Today on The Exchange, Genetic Biography of the United States, Oxford professor and renowned geneticist Brian Sykes is joining us to discuss his new book, DNA USA, in which he takes us on a historical genetical tour of this country and reveals some intriguing connections. We want to hear from you as well at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Have you had a chance to have your DNA sampled? Were you surprised with what you found? Do you work in the field of genetics, or do you use DNA in your job? Are you excited about the use of DNA to explore our culture and our past? Let's hear from you at 1-800-892-6477 or exchange at nhpr.org. One of the places that you started was Boston, and Boston has, of course, the New England Historical Genealogy Society, which is very well known and very big. So what were you looking to learn through the work you did in Boston, and what did you end up finding?
Well, as you said, America's an enormous country, so I had to do some sort of focusing. So I focused on three groups, and in Boston I was very interested to talk to and to sample, if I could, the descendants of early European settlers. And through the society, the New England Society, I really wanted to find some volunteers whose ancestors had arrived before 1650 or 1700 at the latest. And I thought, well, I'll be lucky to get, you know, half a dozen. But actually, there was something like 500 volunteers who responded to requests. So it was a hard job to whittle those down to reasonable numbers. What I was looking for there was whether or not, I suppose geneticists have a slightly jaundiced view about what happens when people meet, in the sense that I was expecting to find that there would have been quite a lot of evidence of intermixing, intermarriage, or if not intermarriage, interbreeding between early European settlers and Native Americans. And one of the most astonishing findings of the book, although in a way it isn't particularly colourful, was that I found virtually none. So I don't know how they how that happened, because I'm perfectly I'm fairly sure that there would have been intermixing with Native Americans, but I can only conclude that any offspring were excluded from the European communities.
Meaning they went to live with the Native Americans and essentially moved out of your European-based society.
That's right, because if you look at Native American DNA from that part of the world, which is actually extremely hard to find, you do find plenty of evidence of European DNA. So it was a one-way DNA introgression into Native American communities, but leaving no evidence, really, in the New England communities. There was just one person who had a piece of Native American DNA, a very senior genealogist who had done a lot of work on his own family and knew that he had a Mohawk ancestor something like 12 generations back. And I was able to pinpoint the piece of DNA and exactly where it was on which chromosome that had come from that ancestor. And it turned out that it covers the genes that control his blood group. So his blood group has come down to him directly from this Mohawk ancestor 12 generations ago.
And I wanted to ask about that. How much of what we know about a person's DNA would actually affect them in that way, rather than being sort of a part of a cultural makeup, but would actually, say, control the pigmentation? How related is that to, say, the pigmentation gene with someone who has more or a less amount of DNA from African sources?
Well, that was a great thing about the new test that I've been using, which can look at an individual and can say with good accuracy which part of their genome and which genes have been inherited from different ancestors in a very broad way, African, European, or Native American. And that was the fascination for me, that in America you have the convergence of three continents, Africa, Europe, and the Native Americans, and that was the overall aspect of it that I wanted to examine with this new test. So the new test in the case we were just talking about, the Mohawk ancestor, I could show that it was the blood group genes are involved in that. In my own case, I've got an African ancestor, and my insulin genes are controlled by that African ancestor. So metaphorically, you could say that since insulin is made in the pancreas, that I've got a black pancreas. But
it's a very diverse pancreas.
A very diverse pancreas. Well, of course, the thing is that even though the genes in myself that run my pancreas are a mixture of African and European in my case, they've got to get on. Otherwise, my pancreas wouldn't work and I wouldn't be talking to you today. And so that's generally a fascination that from the kind of work that I was able to do in DNA USA and to tease apart which genes had come from which ancestry among those individuals that gave me their DNA. Very interesting results.
And as you know, and as you've learned, some of these connections can be provocative. I'm thinking in terms of, say, white Southerners who have African DNA, and given the history of race relations in that part of the country, you can get a wide variety of reactions from people when they learn that.
That's quite right. I mean, in stark contrast to what I found in New England, the European Americans from the South, all the ones that I tested, I didn't test vast numbers by any means, but all of them had sometimes fairly considerable amounts of African-American DNA, but all of them had some African-American ancestors. Their reaction, on the whole, they were pleased to hear about this, so they were interested in it. But I did hear that some of their relatives were quite upset. And I never actually got the chance to test anyone from, for example, any white supremacists or members of the KKK, because if I had, and had they been from the South, I'm perfectly sure that they would have had African ancestors, and they might want to deny that. But then I'd say, well, listen, I can tell from this test that, let's say, your kidneys or your heart muscles are actually run in your body by the DNA from your African ancestor. And then the follow-up question will be, well, that being the case, would you rather have your kidneys removed? And, of course, I think by then the reality of their ancestry would hit home.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. We're talking about DNA USA, a genetic biography of the United States, with Oxford professor and renowned geneticist Brian Sykes. And we'd love to hear from you as well at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. People take ancestry very seriously. We don't, for example, say, my ancestors came here from Ireland. We say, I am Irish, or I am Irish-American. Even if we were born in the United States, we still think of ourselves in that way.
Yeah, that's quite right. I mean, the form of words is interesting, isn't it? I remember famously that Oprah Winfrey, when she was going to have her DNA tested for her African roots, she said, I am a Zulu, not I am a businesswoman television presenter, which is what, of course, she is. She is not a Zulu, but the formal words I am rather than my ancestors were just, I think, accentuates how close a connection people have with their ancestors and sense of identity. Yes, I see it all the time.
And sometimes that can lead to conclusions that are at odds with that definition of self or definition of the cultural self. And we mentioned this at the beginning of the show, but Native American creation stories, sometimes that's an uncomfortable place for Native Americans to look into the genetics because of that.
Yes, I think it is. And still, Native Americans are very suspicious and dismissive of genetic findings because they disagree with so fundamentally with their own ideas about their origins. And very understandable why that might be. But fortunately, what's happening at the nowadays is that Native American scientists are beginning to take up the genetics investigations again, because there are advantages to Native American communities, to any communities, in embracing genetics to try and improve aspects of healthcare and find out about what diseases are particularly prevalent, genetic diseases in any communities. And there I draw a comparison between the Native Americans and the Jewish communities. Both of those have very good reasons to be suspicious of genetics for reasons that we've already gone into. But whereas the Native Americans do not want to get involved with genetics, the Ashkenazi Jews have embraced it. To start with, because it helped them identify and then eventually cut the incidence of a very unpleasant genetic disease called Tay-Sachs, which was particularly common amongst Ashkenazi Jews. And they've done it. I mean, it's been virtually eliminated amongst Ashkenazi Jews by screening and by knowing what causes the disease. But all of this has been done by, or led by, Jewish scientists, and I think that is the difference, that the Native American ancestral work, genealogy work, the DNA work on Native Americans has not been done really at all by Native Americans themselves. So I hope that was about to change.
I was going to ask, maybe how do you and other researchers address those concerns, but maybe it's who addresses those concerns that winds up being the issue. We're going to take a short break here now, Brian, so please stay with us. And well, we have some callers on the line, which is great. We'd love to get you into the conversation as well at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll have more with Brian Sykes on DNA USA coming up after a short break. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
Nowadays, science and religion do daily battle.
The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown blew that battleground wide open.
Both vying to be that infallible source from which we draw our truth.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Join Dan and me at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on May 18th. Tickets and information for this special benefit for writers on a New England stage are at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Jaguar Exeter, serving New Hampshire and Vermont, featuring the new 2012 Jaguar XJ. Agile, responsive, and refined in Jaguar XJ, online at jaguarexeter.com. And Palace Theater in Manchester in its Broadway New Hampshire series presenting Legally Blonde and the musical May 4th to the 19th. Tickets at palacetheater.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we look at changes in the presidential primary process, from Facebook to super PACs. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org, and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for The Exchange. Today, we're talking about DNA USA, a genetic portrait of America. Join us with your questions and comments by calling in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest today, Oxford professor and renowned geneticist Brian Sykes. He's the author of several books on genetics. His newest book, DNA USA, comes out May 1st. Brian, let's go to the phones now. Michael is calling from Berlin. Michael, you're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning, Brady, and good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
I wanted to say thank you very much for bringing the topic of eugenics into the forefront. I am of Abenaki heritage, and so Henry Perkins and others who began the eugenics program affected thinking as a people by way of the insidious nature of what they were actually doing in using their what they called genetics, and they affected several hundred people, particularly in Vermont and parts of New Hampshire, by way of taking people with Indian blood and either sterilizing them or operating on them or keeping them confined in facilities. And in response to what you had said about checking Europeans in your Boston study, I think part of the reason that you may not have found Indian blood within or genetics within them is that Indian people were viewed, as you may know historically, as savages. And so offspring would have gone with their Indian counterparts. For example, if you were Indian, you could not be buried in a European cemetery and things of that nature. So the intermixing, some of it occurred much later, you know, particularly in the 1800s, you would... Like myself, I'm of Norwegian, European, and Abenaki heritage. So, but from an Indian standpoint, even giving blood for purposes of insurance purposes and things like that, I always have reservations about giving my blood to anybody for anything. Mm. So, but those were my comments, and again. Thank you for bringing your studies to the forefront, and I would only say that from our standpoint, and you've alluded to this, is that we say that we've always been here. We believe that, the history of our people, it's always been trying to prove, in the past at least. In some way, we were far inferior to our European counterparts.
And always having to then give up more, including in this case, the DNA. Michael, great points. I wanted to give Brian a chance to respond.
Yes, well, thank you, Michael. That's very interesting to hear from you. Can I ask you a question? And that is that you have a Norwegian and a Native American background. Are you interested in your European ancestors?
I do have I have one family member who does a lot of genealogy, and they've taken, you know, they've gone back into, in some cases, the 1600s, back further into both the Norwegian and European lineage.
Yeah, so it's both aspects of your ancestry that of course are coming together, but it's always very shocking to see how different peoples have treated each other in the past, and one can only almost stagger disbelief in what sort of things went on. But I'm afraid that's been going on a lot longer than the European adventures in North America. I mean, the Roman attitude to people in other parts of Europe is equally bad. So let's hope that, it's a grand claim, but I don't know whether knowing more about the one's individual ancestry and how mixed it always is going to help temper these attitudes. Well, I can only hope it does a little bit.
Michael, thank you so much for that call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Let's go next to Mel, who's calling from Stratford. Mel, you're on the exchange.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm always fascinated with programs about genetics. I have had my DNA analyzed. I'm originally from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I'm descended from the original Spanish colonists in New Mexico, dating back to the 1600s, and because of that Spanish ancestry, I am a real mongrel when it comes to genetics. I am predominantly European, I think somewhere in the 60%, but I have a 23% Native American component as well as sub-Saharan African, and my maternal mitochondria is native, so I just always am fascinated by that, particularly with the history of Spain and then the history of Spain in the U.S. You can see the mixing was tremendous.
A little bit of everything, a little bit like myself, actually. Mel, thanks for that call. Brian?
Yes, that's right. I mean, what Mel experienced accentuates actually that one of the is the use of the mitochondrial maternal ancestry to get back to the indigenous ancestry. That's often the best way of doing it, through the maternal DNA, in her case, back to Native Americans. What happened when in the Spanish colonies, the colonization, and you can see this, is the paternal European genes, particularly those carried on the Y chromosome, are very widespread in Mexico and in southwestern United States. And that's because of the activities of Spanish men. Whereas the maternal ingredient is usually, and in all cases of this similar cases, is usually much stronger representation of the indigenous DNA, because, of course, it's come down through lines of women. So I think Mel is a very good example of that.
Mel, thank you for that call. And I wanted to ask about, since you mentioned the American Southwest, I wanted to ask about one of the richest discoveries you describe in the book. People in the American Southwest and in Mexico, often American Catholics, who have a connection to European Jews.
Yes, that was one of my most surprising aspects, really. What happened was that a few people had their DNA tested, and they showed a Y chromosome, in this case, that's one of the pieces of DNA that goes from father to son, that had been in the past very closely connected with the hereditary priesthood of Judaism, the Kohanim, and it's widespread amongst Jews. You find it elsewhere as well, but it's not a specific Jewish gene. But nonetheless, when they had their DNA tested, found that a lot of people, quite a lot of people from the southwest United States and from Mexico, carried this Y chromosome with the Jewish connections. And they'd also remember vaguely family practices, that things like covering mirrors, other kinds of, although they were Catholics, when they found out about this, they thought, well, hello, I wonder whether why that explains why we've been carrying on these Jewish practices in the family. And what had actually happened was this. In 1492, not only did Columbus come across the Atlantic, but also in Spain, there was an edict issued in the March of 1492 to all Jews in Spain to clear out by July. Or if they didn't clear out, then they had to convert to Catholicism. Now, many, many left and went to different parts of Europe. But some remained and converted reluctantly to Catholicism. But the sincerity of that conversion was then examined later by the Spanish Inquisition very brutally. And what happened was that many people thought, well, you know, we're not going to survive this. So they came over to the Spanish colonies in America that were beginning to form, where there were no Inquisition. But it didn't last long, because the Inquisition came over to the Spanish colonies, and so they once again had to hide their religion, which they did, but clearly not completely, because the people then had their DNA tested and realized that they had been Jews all along, or their ancestry was Jewish, not Catholic, and they formally converted into to Judaism on the news from that genetic test. Some of them did that, went as far as that. So it was a most surprising result to me to see the effect of those genetic tests.
Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And we have an email here from Steve, who asks, if human beings originated from Africa, don't we all have African DNA at a certain level? And Africa has long been known to be the cradle of humanity. So how does that fit into the DNA of of all of us.
Well, that's absolutely right. We did all start in Africa probably 200,000 years ago. The test that I use in DNA USA, though, looks at more recent ancestry. So when I've identified a piece of DNA that is of African origin, then that means of recent African origin over the last few hundred years in the case of African Americans, and in my case, maybe going back to the time of the Roman Empire, which is only 2,000 years ago. So recent African origin. But Steve's absolutely right that you can very easily map back the genetic inheritance of everybody back to regions of probably East, Northeast Africa, at least 200,000 years ago.
Steve, thank you for that email. And speaking of African Americans, I thought it was really poignant in the book how you describe some African Americans have looked to genetic work and as a way to reconnect with a history that in many cases was literally destroyed, but records were either not kept or they were only kept for the work of slave trading. Some people have said genetics are a way to finally own their own history.
Yes, that's right. I'm glad you brought that up, because African Americans have benefited greatly, I think, from DNA, because they can trace their connection back to Africa, and using usually mitochondrial DNA, which is, as I've mentioned before, very good for looking at deep ancestry. Using mitochondrial DNA, have been able to identify where their maternal ancestors might have come from in Africa, the region in Africa. And many have visited that, and I think got a lot of benefit from getting that connection, which before was never open to them through the records, because unlike European Americans, who have large numbers of records they can look up to establish their genealogy, that isn't open to African Americans with African ancestors, because the records were not kept and the slave owners deliberately tried to suppress their own sense of individuality and sever the connections with Africa. So it's been a revelation for many African Americans, and a very welcome one.
And often, as these things go, as we've seen through the course of this conversation, there are also connections to other parts of the world. So many African Americans also find some European DNA. And what are the reactions you get in those cases?
Well, I think probably all African Americans have got some European ancestry. Certainly all the ones I tested did, and quite fairly substantial amounts, always over 10% and sometimes a lot more. Now, it did come as a great surprise to many of my volunteers that they had any European ancestry at all, because they're so closely identified with their African genealogy. But there it is, and I think when people saw it, surprise, but then, like a lot of these things, eventually settled down, and often by talking to other members of the family, would find out that there was someone in the family who might have been white, who might have been European. The highest the gene that comes through, rather like we were talking about with with Mel and her Spanish ancestry, the gene with the highest frequency that we see in African Americans again comes from Y chromosomes, from European Y chromosomes, where a third of African Americans have European Y chromosomes, and that's the result of sexual liaisons, usually between slave owners and their slaves, which was extremely frequent. And I think, understandably, that's not really something that African Americans necessarily welcome. But there it is, and it's running their DNA, and after they'd had time to think about it, all my African American volunteers were happy about it.
One last question for you. We've been talking about movement and diversity among peoples and cultures throughout basically all of human history, but with globalization, it seems like there's more movement than ever before, and it's certainly not just limited to the United States. How might that affect a professor of genetics doing this kind of work, say, in 1,000 years or 2,000 years from now?
Oh, heavens. I mean, one tends to think, oh heavens, everyone's going to end up looking the same and having total mixing with their DNA. But I don't think that's the case. I mean, even now, you're right that you get astonishing examples. I remember finding a teacher in Edinburgh in Scotland who had a Polynesian ancestor. So that DNA must have travelled halfway around the globe. And we get lots of little examples of that, of where you have occurrences of DNA in people's ancestry that they knew nothing about, but are very, very exotic. And that's just, I suppose, going to increase as people move around a little, rather more. But in 1,000 years, I don't suppose there will be any professors of genetics.
We'll have computers doing it, I suppose. Brian, I could talk about this all day, but we're out of time. Thanks so much for being with us. Great talking with you.
My pleasure.
Brian Sykes is a professor of human genetics at the University of Oxford, founder of Oxford Ancestors, and author of several books on genetics, including his latest, DNA USA. You can find out more about his book and continue the conversation at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Ryan Lessard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.